from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll go behind the scenes of the IRT's Christmas Carol.
I'll meet a husband and wife who are here in India as part of a We Are City Artist Import Residency.
And I'll chat with Dan Carpenter about his new book, Out Loud. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Indiana Repertory Theater's production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol has been a tradition for decades of Indianapolis residents. Sharon Gamble invited the theater's executive artistic director, Janet Allen, and cast member, Emily Ristine, in to learn more about what makes this production rewarding and how they keep it fresh.
So we're all happy and gleeful because it's Christmas Carol time around. Does it just come sooner every year, or is it just me?
Yes, Sharon. Actually, I don't know. It doesn't feel like that to me this year so much because... Maybe it's because Hanukkah and Thanksgiving are the same week.
Yeah, there you go.
It's all a little confusing this year, but we welcome the snow play always.
The snow play, that's right. So we can't assume that everybody who's hearing our conversation has seen your production of Christmas Carol. It's a legend. The legend stretches back... I'm doing some math in my head, almost before Emily was born.
I think so,
way before Janet's time at the IRT.
Actually, no, sadly.
No?
I was there for the first, I was right out of graduate school.
Oh my gosh.
My first job as a literary manager at the IRT on the first Christmas Carol in a year that, yes, I'm going to say it, 1980.
And I was very much alive then.
She was. But she was a wee thing.
She was a wee lass. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely right. So tell us about why this production was created.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did that first production, Sharon, for 4 years in the early 80s. And then we, silly us, stopped doing it.
Why?
You know, I wish I could really give you a reasonable answer about that, but I think we did not understand its power in an ongoing sense.
And I
also think that we were not smart about how you have to keep it alive, both for audiences and for artists.
And tinker with it.
Yeah, you have to always be tinkering with it. And so when we revived it in 1996... And the only reason I can remember that, Emily, is because my oldest child was a wee babe then.
Aww.
I was 17.
Wow.
We had been talking about it for a handful of years, bringing it back. And we did a whole new production of it then, which is why we now call it the Snow Play, because now it's on the beautiful snow field.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have done it for 18 years in this second production. It's phenomenal that long. But what that means is that you saw it as a young woman. You now bring your children to see it.
Absolutely.
Your parents have been seeing it now going into three generations.
Well, and I started doing it in 1999.
You did not.
Yes.
You were 12.
No, it wasn't. I was just out of school. And it was the first year that Chuck Goad played Scrooge. It was the first year that I did it.
Yeah.
So it's, you know. Then we've been doing it, and many of us in this cast have been doing it since then or before.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So actors are famous, theater is a famous field for people wanting to do something new, tackle new challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that makes you want to still be affiliated with this production, even though, you know, your roles have changed over the years? You also are wearing another hat as assistant stage manager?
You are, Em.
She's looking at Janet to say, is that real?
It's a kind of technicality of the union contract, Sharon.
Oh, got it.
I think I
say no more.
Probably wasn't supposed to say that. Yeah. Oh, well. Yes, she is.
Yes, I'm not really. Yeah, let me tell you all the things I do with that. what was the, back to the other
What makes you want to keep coming back?
You know, I think it's sort of like a home for the holidays feel. You know, there's many roles that we take on during the year that we just don't know anything about, and we are wondering how the production will turn out and what kind of a challenge it will be. And it's nice, especially around the holidays, to spend that time at home with, I mean, very much with our people. It's so many local people. There are so many people who have returned. This is my fifth time. And it's, I've never done the Carol with this group of people, but mm-hmm. I have worked with all but one of the people in the show before. So it's so nice to just come home and know exactly what we're going to be doing around the holidays and to spend it with the artists from our community.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what makes it special for us.
You know, we mentioned Chuck Goad, who had a long term as Scrooge, and Ryan Artsberger is in his what? How many years is this?
You know, I think it's five or six.
Oh my gosh, that was fast.
I don't.
I think Chuck did it for 11 years.
That's right, Em. So then, and this is 18, so this is seven.
Well, no, because he started in 1999, so then he would have been done in 2010.
Okay. Okay, so
this is is this Ryan's third year?
Three or four.
Listen, yes.
We don't know.
No. Well, and Ryan was in it before when Chuck was in it as other roles.
Ryan's been played a zillion roles in it. So this is like four, maybe four.
Maybe four.
Yeah. Maybe four for Ryan. And that is also the same time that Richard Roberts started directing it.
Right, right.
They were newbies together in that relationship.
So talk to me a little bit about this, because what's so interesting about theater is a lot of times people in any given community, and Indianapolis is no exception, wear different hats at different times. So they might be a stage manager, they might be a director, they might be an actor, they might be a literary manager. And what is it like to change roles? You are a producer for this one, Janet. Mm-hmm. Emily, you are an actor for this one, but you do a lot of directing and producing. Mm-hmm. So do you do something to, do you duck into a phone booth and say, okay, now I am an actor, or do you do anything to change that up? Mm-hmm. Or is your thinking kind of seamless as you go back and forth among those different roles?
It is definitely, they are different roles for sure. But I think, you know, it's theater is such an ensemble art, and there's such a beautiful spirit of collaboration, especially with something like The Christmas Carol, because it has been directed and produced for so many years, and so many people have done the roles before you, and you do sort of take their legacy and things that have worked well. And as a director, you do that. And as an actor, you do that. And as a choreographer, you do that. You know, we have just sort of the stories of Christmas Carol pasts that we always bring to the production each year.
Mm. Tell me about the table read for this. Was there anything that jumped out at you as, okay, and this year, here's something wildly different we want to try, or here's how we want to evolve it?
There's a bunch of new stuff in it, actually, Sharon. There's a new scene in it that we haven't done in years. And part of this is we're working from a version that originally was about 2 hours and 10 minutes of playing time that we now play in 90 minutes.
And not so, because everyone's talking fast, we should mention.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Right.
Yes, but because we actually edited it and compressed it.
Yeah.
And a large piece of that, we did that 4 years ago, I think. And a lot of that was because we wanted to be able to continue to play this to a huge number of students. It'll play to about 15,000 kids from all over the state.
Wow.
And we also, going into the recession, needed to kind of compress the footprint of it.
Sure.
So we moved into the production methodology that would allow us to do two shows a day, Monday through Friday, for kids.
Yikes.
Which is a huge thing to ask a company to do.
It is.
And the first year we did that, we talked a lot about it, and we talked about the whys, and people were incredibly game, and they remain incredibly game. But because of that, there are scenes that we have eliminated at various times, and it's always fun to listen to audiences say, well, where's such and such? And oh my gosh, you haven't done that for a while. But also this year, there's a lot of music in it.
Hmm.
Some years we do very little sung music in it because we don't cast it with singers.
Right.
And this year, Emily and Hillary Smith and Millicent Wright can lead out that female voice work. And so we put a lot more music back in it for that express purpose.
Cool.
Because we love having music in it. But some years it's more heavy on the acting side, and other years it's got a lot more music in it. So here's the quiz question, because my 14-year-old child will have opinions about this because she is encyclopedic about Christmas Carol. She'll say, well, you cut the best part, Mom. Or why'd you put that in? You
know, that's, wow, nothing like having a critic right there in your household.
I got it. This year what we put a scene that we call Belle's husband in, which is in, of course, they're all the scenes are from the story itself, but mm-hmm. it's when the young man Scrooge, after Belle breaks up with him mm-hmm. and says, you have changed so much and how avaricious you have become. And then there's a flash forward and he sees through a window Belle and her husband, who's unnamed, and their children
oh.
gathered in front of a Christmas tree.
Oh,
and he
cool.
has a twinge. He has a big twinge of what did I lose? What
yeah.
did I pass up? Which is a piece of his journey, which we've excluded for the last three
and
years.
It's such a great scene.
It's gorgeous.
Oh, that sounds
and
lovely.
And Richard and I, every year, talk about, well, what do we feel like the story is missing? What do we want to tinker with?
Mm-hmm.
And every year, we tinker a little bit with the storytelling.
What a treat. It keeps it fresh. Keeps
and
it a challenge.
The other thing that's nice about that scene, I narrate that scene, so I'm out there, is that it's the most recent of all of the sort of flashbacks that you
mm-hmm.
see. It's just like 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you flash back and see sort of all of Scrooge's moments and the mistakes that he's made. But there you see sort of this last moment that my line is Scrooge, now grown older and harder, passed by on his way home to another solitary Christmas.
Oh, mm-hmm. oh that's heart-wrenching.
I know.
Just hearing.
And it's so, it's a really, it's a beautiful, it helps to really drive home the idea to the audience that he's still, even 7 years ago, he still had a sense of loneliness and vulnerability that maybe mm-hmm. now has just turned to hardness.
And it's also mm-hmm. instructive in a way the original mm-hmm. was meant to be. It's about mm-hmm. the choices we make.
Yeah. Indeed.
So little people are going to hear that and see that. And
indeed. The other thing that's always fun about that first read is there's always new voices in it.
Yeah. So Rob Johansson as the Ghost of Christmas Past. That scares me just saying it out loud. Oh, my gosh.
Very
chilling.
Cool. Well,
yeah.
And we've had a woman play that role for mm-hmm. the last 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a situation where we offered it to Cora Vandenbroek, who's been playing it for a number of years, but she had taken other work
mm-hmm.
this year. And so we had to rethink it.
Right.
And I said to Richard, I think we should not try to replace her with a woman because
and
let's just
comparing.
Break it open further
yeah,
than
right.
that. Let's yeah. cast a man. And then he and I noodled and said, you know what, let's put Rob in that
mm-hmm.
and just see what happens.
Mm.
And it's so there's that. There's brand new people to it, but there's also people who've played a bunch of roles who are playing new roles
yeah.
for the first time, and that's always exciting.
We also have a great new Bob Cratchit.
We
and
do.
He brings such
we
a great
do.
Energy to it. And Mark Scheibmeier.
Yeah.
Mark Scheibmeier, a new L.A.-based actor who comes to us because he is an alum of University of Texas, where our new associate artistic director, Courtney Sale, is from. So
uh-huh.
she's bringing a new
good
sort of crop of actors
yeah,
to
yeah.
us, of people that she knows. And Mark was one of them. And we said, let's hire him. So
some offstage traditions that are coming back. There are reindeer.
Oh, yes. Well, we love doing sort of things that happen before the show
yeah.
and after the show.
Yeah.
So inviting people once in a while to come on stage. And yes, we have a live reindeer that comes to visit us for
yay.
A couple performances. We have choirs we invite to sing in the lobby before the show. We do hot chocolate. We do a variety of kind of fun holiday activities.
Families can get their photos taken in front of the tree.
Indeed, Sharon. So we like to give a lovely sort of afternoon or evening of a show as well as some other things to do to get you in the holiday spirit.
Exactly.
Sharon Gamble with the IRT's Executive Artistic Director Janet Allen and Christmas Carol cast member Emily Rasteen. A Christmas Carol runs through Christmas Eve, and you can get tickets and find out when you can meet the reindeer at irtlive.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. We Are City is a pretty hip email that comes out twice a week with brief features of what's going on in Indy or what is going on in the world that we might like to have going on here. One other program that We Are City has going on is their import program that brings in creative people from other cities to be in residence here. Currently, their third import program is underway with the husband and wife team of Jace Clayton, a.k.a. DJ Rupture, and Rocio Rodriguez Salcida. Travis DiNicola sat down with them and with We Are City's John Beeler to learn more.
Rocio, Jace, John, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you all in the studio.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. So, John, let's start with you. I want to talk a little bit about We Are City because it's a pretty cool conglomeration of programs. I'm not sure how else you guys describe it. I mean, you've got your email newsletter, you've got import and some other things going on. But give me a little sort of the quick summary of We Are City, then we'll talk about import.
Yep. Well, thanks for having us, Travis.
Absolutely.
We Are City is a labor of love that we formed a couple of years ago, and we do three things. We send out an email twice a week that captures city improvement news for both Indianapolis and other cities across the world. We do a summit each year, which is a yearly conference, and it brings together interesting people. So these are like the up-and-coming indie rock stars of TED Talks, if you could think of it that way.
And sure. Yeah.
It's a half-day conference. We do that in August or September.
And it was excellent this past year.
Well, thanks, Travis.
Yeah.
Yeah, we really enjoyed doing it. And then the one that we're here for today is import. So we've done this. Jason and Rocio are our third import residence. It's essentially a residency for people that are examining, thinking, improving cities. And they come and we kind of leave it up to them as to what they're going to accomplish here. They kind of observe and participate and then every single person has come up with something really, really interesting.
And we've had some of your past imports on here on the show before. And it's an interesting mix because it's certainly creative people, not necessarily artists, but people who obviously have an artistic bent. I mean, could you talk briefly about the past two imports that you've had before? And because you also have some great partners in this that make this possible for these people to come to Indy.
We sure do. So Zoe was our first import. This was about a year and a half ago, and he took bacteria that's in our waterways and cast these huge paramecium small creatures onto the side of Clues Hall. It was terrifying, actually. Our second import was earlier this year with James Reeves and Oliver Blank from Civic Center in New Orleans. And they left the soul of Indianapolis. So they asked a bunch of people and took interviews.
Really interesting guys.
Yeah, they were great, right?
Yeah. I mean, part of their project was people were sort of calling up to this, phone number where they'd leave a message basically talking about what their memory or sense of Indianapolis was, right?
Yeah.
And then that was turned into this whole sort of other project.
Yeah, so there's a book out, the Bureau of Manufactured History. There's an actual bureau, which is a very heavy desk that we have to move around a lot, and it's it's the soul of Indianapolis. So if you sit down and put your head on the desk, you'll hear this composition that Oliver created that weaves in stories and sounds and music. It's like a 30 or 40 minute composition, and it's just gorgeous.
So how does We Are City decide who you're going to import? I mean, you and the other people who are part of We Are City, and this is not you're not actually really accepting applications. I mean, you're sort of going out and seeking people.
It's a long, bureaucratic, complicated process of making it up on the fly.
Excellent. Yeah.
We have a great network of people from working at record labels and from Tim Carter's work at the Center for Urban Ecology. And we just know great people who know great people who know great people. So, and we're able to do this through sponsorships. In this particular case, the residences at Cityway have been host to Jason Rocio, and we've had some other sponsors like Osborne and Stillman installed this amazing furniture in there that's just gorgeous. And the IAHI from IUPUI has helped us cover expenses as well. So there's a lot of great people that have helped out on this.
That's excellent. One last question for you, and then I'm really looking forward to talking to Jason Rocio. How did you hear about these two, though, in terms of finding them, or what did you had heard about them before?
Yeah, I think actually Michael Kaufman was the one who knew you guys maybe directly. Maybe they can speak to that a little bit. But they also know Roberto Lange, who is an artist on the label named Gelato Negro is the moniker he goes by. And you guys have worked with Roberto before, I think. So.
Okay, cool. So, well, welcome to Art of the Matter. And it's great having the two of you in residence here at the city. Jace, when I had a chance to meet with you earlier, a couple weeks ago, we were talking, and of course, you and Rocio are married, but this is really the first time you've worked together in an artistic pursuit as a couple. Is that right?
Exactly, yes.
Tell me a bit about your work. Let's start with you, Jace.
Well, I come from a background primarily as a DJ and often working with sound, you know, so I've traveled all over the world as DJ Rupture, performing, like, was in a band with Norah Jones, did stuff with the Barcelona Symphony Orchestra, playing
Very cool.
in all sorts of contexts.
Yeah.
And so lately I've been kind of expanding outwards from that. And so engaged in more art projects, you know, I've got a software as art project called Sufi Plugins. And I'm doing some more sort of performance-based pieces that involve music.
And Rocio, you're not a performance-based artist at all, right?
No.
Tell me about your work.
I've been a visual artist for many years. And it's been in the past year that since I worked in many different medias, I combined them all in fashion design.
Okay.
So that's what I do now.
So the two of you, when you were asked to come to Indianapolis as part of Import, did you have an idea at that point as far as what you wanted to work on together? Or was just sort of like, oh, well, this is kind of a cool opportunity?
Yeah, we had the seed of an idea because neither of us had been to Indianapolis.
Okay.
But we started talking about ways in which we could work together for the first time. And so that led us, long, many talks and discussions, but we ended up with this idea of capes.
Yeah. Like, how did you come up with capes?
this is a funny story. So as it turns out, like doing the very preliminary research on Indianapolis, we're like, okay, there's this history of like late in the 20s, like KKK, really powerful here, mayor and all these things. And so thinking of that visually, like these white peaks, and you're like, obviously, that's not a history that we're interested in dealing with at all. But then we started thinking of like almost ways to cleanse it, you know, Rocio Spanish, you know, and that dress comes from the Seville Catholic Easter progressions. And
before there were superheroes.
Exactly. Before there were superheroes. So these terrible peaks. But then we're like, what about capes as the kind of opposite to that, as this kind of this celebration? What about beautiful, colorful capes as a celebration of diversity? And it's all about gathering people together, but in a very kind of like open and exploratory way.
Okay.
And so that was what led us to that piece of fashion.
Mm-hmm. And so your project is, I'm trying to sort of still understand, but you're actually creating a series of capes that the intent is that people will wear around the city. They'll be displayed. I know there's other elements to them as well, and we'll get into. But sort of what's the end product here that you're working towards?
So the residency is a month, and it ends this week.
Right.
And we're still working on these capes.
Okay.
And so we are going to return actually to the We Are City Summit in August, and with this idea of activating the capes.
Excellent.
And so right now I think it's. You know, it's the work in progress, but I think it's going to be choosing some of the individuals we've met over our time here and working with them to think of a spot that has meaning to them in the city, photographing them in that space.
Sure.
And then the capes will be later displayed along with the photos in a gallery setting.
Okay. Now, there's another element about these capes that I kind of find very fascinating, because I mean, certainly one of the most famous capes of recent use is the Cloak of Invisibility in like the Harry Potter movies and books.
Yes.
And there is an element of invisibility about these capes that you're creating. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rocio?
I think I should
explain it. Jace?
Okay, you can talk about the fabric later, because there have been new developments even then. Yeah, so interested in playing with these ideas. Like, they're meant to be worn by a group in public, very flamboyant. Who are those people with those crazy capes?
You can't not see them.
And yet, inside, And the fabric is special. We can talk about that in a second. But inside, the interior layer is Mylar blankets.
Okay.
Like they're called space blankets. Like once you've run a marathon, you get that sort of shiny material.
Yeah, to keep you warm and
exactly.
They're very thin, right?
And okay. As it turns out, one of their other properties is they block electromagnetic radiation.
Huh.
So if you're wearing this cape, you won't get a cell phone signal. And so the idea is you're hyper-visible in the city, but you're mm-hmm. digitally cloaked.
That's
as
very
you move
cool.
around.
Yeah. I love that idea. Which could be a lot of fun. I mean, especially like, oh, I throw my cape. Oh, I, you know, what a great excuse. I didn't get your call. I had my cape on.
I was wearing my superhero cape.
Exactly. Tell me about the fabric.
Have we spoken about the two cities, Tijuana and Tijuana?
Nope. Oh, not yet. Yeah, we'll get to that in just a moment. Yeah.
Yes. So when we arrived to Indianapolis, we walked a lot around the city. We like to do that everywhere we go to get a sense of the city. And we were investigating about the city, and one interesting factor we found about is that in the 1800s, the urban plan of Tijuana was copied from Indianapolis. So we suddenly
thought...
That
is so wild. I'd never heard that before. and so I met you guys, that Tijuana was copied off of the Indianapolis
yes.
sort of plan for how the city's laid out.
Yes, and that was a very interesting idea. And we wanted to explore that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were thinking, we already decided about the capes. And one thing I wanted to do in Indianapolis was to buy fabric from here and build the capes with fabric from here. But when we found out about Tijuana, then we thought it would be beautiful if we could put these two cities together
yeah.
in the piece we're building. So we decided to investigate a little bit more about this factor with the urban plan in Tijuana itself, go to the city, and buy fabric from there too.
Okay.
So
you're using a mix of both fabric from Tijuana as well as Indianapolis?
Yes, together.
Okay. And so mixed in the same capes?
Yes, mixed in the same capes.
Very, very cool.
So we traveled to Tijuana. It was the first time for me to go to Tijuana. And it's been very interesting also at the level of the different people we've met in the two cities too.
Yeah.
Because these two cities, we get in the sense that there are so many creative people wanting, thinking in future and thinking in like ways to bring art and to the cities. So... It's been an interesting parallel story going on with these two cities. So
I'm sure.
I can wait to see when I'm creating these capes, I'm creating these capes thinking in these experiences together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you must have run into a few people who are going, what are you guys talking about? Capes in Tijuana and Indianapolis and cloaked cell phones. And every now and then.
Yeah, it happens. You know, it's funny. I think increasingly artists, we have... There is a license to do things. Like
yeah.
a friend of mine back in New York, he's like, he's laughing at me. He's like, I can't believe it. He's like, you're getting paid to go out there and make capes. He's like, it's inspiring, but I don't understand it.
It's a pretty cool thing. I mean, the whole We Are City Import project, I find just kind of fascinating. Because, I mean, you guys really, you bring in these artists, but you're not necessarily giving them a whole lot of parameters to work from, right?
No.
I mean, is there, I mean, some sort of mandate that they come up with something that can be shown or exhibited or...
I think it, Travis, it's kind of constructing itself as we go.
Yeah.
But really, we try to create a platform for our residents to meet people.
Mm-hmm.
And so really it just comes from them interacting and researching and meeting people and getting to know folks. And it seems to have worked out so far. We might have to change that if we ever get a resident who just sits around and doesn't do anything. But so far, all the
isn't
residents have worked
yeah.
extremely hard.
Yeah.
And so anytime I drop by there are residents at Cityway there's fabric everywhere
yeah.
and plants. So, and that was true for Oliver as well. I mean, we helped him move the desk, and James did a lot of writing and meeting and researching. So I think we've just gotten lucky so far. We haven't had to provide a lot of parameters.
Well, let me ask both of you. Rocio, I'll start with you first. What's been the most surprising thing for you about this process? Either something in Indianapolis or just the process itself? Something unexpected you've encountered?
The process and the people we've met. And like I said, when I was mentioning before, being here and then traveling to Tijuana,
yeah.
two cities that I haven't been in ever, and meeting people in both cities, to me, it's like they have become one.
Hmm.
And I've been really inspired by these conversations I've been having in the two cities with different people. That, to me, is it was surprising and really valuable.
Chase, how about you?
That's a great question. I mean, on a similar note, I think one of the things that I found really striking about Indianapolis is that I mean, it's partly the people that we're in contact with who are reaching out, but we've really in touch with this network of people who are very much thinking like this is our city. We want to make it better and a more exciting place to be. Like, how can we do that in concrete ways? Mm-hmm. You know, like a lot of places, like I come from New York City, and it's almost like everything has been done, and it's so in the sense of almost like it's already so built. Whereas here, there's this interesting spirit of kind of like not openness, but interesting spirit of like we can change things and let's make it happen.
There's still things that haven't been done. There's still opportunity here to discover.
Yeah, so that's been quite that's a great surprise.
Excellent. Well, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you both and getting a chance to meet both of you. And I'm so glad you've been in residence here. And John, it's always a pleasure to chat with you and
find out what
We Are City's up to. And wish you the best luck. I can't wait to see the finished capes at next year's summit.
Yes, thanks.
Thank you so much.
All right,
thanks, Travis.
Then.
Travis DiNicola with We Are City's John Beeler and import residents Jace Clayton and Rocio Rodriguez-Salcida. To learn more, visit wearecity.us, wearecity.us. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I sure hope you've made a list because we are so rushed this week trying to get everything in, and we have an extra fast edition of
What Will We Do?
What do you got?
I've made my list. I checked it twice.
Excellent.
There you go. So coming up this weekend on the 13th and 14th, they up at the Indianapolis Arts Center, their very talented faculty are having their first winter art sale. So you can shop around and check out some great unique pieces, including some wearable pieces and decorative and fine arts. And it should be really fun. Friday from 6 to 9, Saturday from 10 to 4, and it includes a whole bunch of some of the best of the Indianapolis Arts Center's faculty that will be having all of their work up there this weekend for sale.
Fantastic. Hey, the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's production and performances of Messiah are taking place this weekend, this Friday at 7:30 and Sunday at 3 at Tabernacle Presbyterian Church at 34th and Washington Boulevard. Also, if you like to sing, they're doing a sing-along version of Messiah at Indiana Landmark Center on Monday, December 16th at 7:30. Not the full Messiah, just highlights, but you can learn more and find out what kind of music you need to procure if you want to come to the sing-along version at icomusic.org, icomusic.org.
Very cool. Well, you know, you've heard us talk quite a bit about The Circus in Winter, the great book by Kathy Day, as well as the musical that was created by Ball State students. Well, they are doing a performance of it with Actors Theater of Indiana. They're presenting it next Wednesday, December 18th, 8 o'clock at the Studio Theater up at the Center for the Performing Arts in Mount Carmel. And it's an exclusive one-night concert with storytelling by Indiana composer Ben Clark. And there's going to be a talkback session with Lou Harry from the IBJ. And this should be a lot of fun. It'd be a great way to see a circus in winter. It's not the full musical production, but it is a concert production of this musical.
It's interesting to see that further developed and as it moves around. Yeah. Hey, this Saturday in Broad Ripple lights up from 2 to 7. You can visit Santa Claus. There are children's activities, live entertainment at the firehouse from 2 to 5. At 5:30, a twilight parade through the heart of the village. And at 6 o'clock, Santa Claus arrives at the firehouse. The firehouse light display includes a 21-foot tree. I'm just saying, bring your cameras or your phone.
Very good. Last thing I got just very quickly, if you haven't seen it yet, A Phoenix Xmas 8 is going on through the 22nd, and it is a ton of fun. Definitely worth seeing.
My last item, the Athenaeum Pops Orchestra Holiday Concert is this Saturday at 12:30 at the Arts Garden at Circle Center Mall. It's free. It's conducted by Dr. Lee H. Jones. Sure to be a lot of fun.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks with that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Dan Carpenter may have retired from his career as the Indianapolis Star's resident voice of the Greek chorus, but he surely has not retired from keenly observing the human condition. Sharon Gamble invited Dan to talk about his recently published book, Indiana Out Loud, Dan Carpenter on the Heartland Beat.
This from the preface. Indiana Out Loud presumes to make itself heard as a distinct voice of this place in this time of economic struggle, political divisiveness, creative persistence, flammable faith, terror brought home, and war seemingly without end or limit. The cumulative sound comprises the sweet and strident, the measured and manic, the deafening and the barely detectable. It is as sharp as the orchestrations of a legendary neighborhood grocer and as seductive as the baritone riffs of a celebrated junkie poet. It shrieks against arbitrary war and enforced poverty. It sings the pain of inevitable loss and the praises of improbable gift-bearers. A cacophony blending into a chorus that packs the urgency of the here and now without losing the heat of our unique history. Can one writer's work capture, possess, and share it, even for one enshrining moment? Any claim I might make for that resides in the audience cultivated over more than two decades as a feature writer and so-called house liberal editorialist for a publication that boasts of a million Sunday readers, but exasperates that large portion of them whose politics place them left of the GOP and often of the Hoosier Democrats. My bent for looking at Indiana and the world from odd angles, portraying them with unexpected language and commenting on them from an idealistic and subversive point of view, have earned loyalty and enmity in roughly equal volumes, as evidenced by a steady flow of mail from throughout the territory and, thanks to the cosmic reach of the Internet, far beyond. An email from Washington, D.C., Tel Aviv, or Port-au-Prince has a way of concentrating the mind of the regional writer. It also reminds him of the old Heartland admonition, don't get above your raisin. Alas, I have to say with a shudder, too late.
Too late in part because a lot of water under that journalistic bridge, and you are, to the disappointment and sadness of many longtime readers, now retired from your Indianapolis Star gig. How does it feel so far?
Sadness and disappointment in my own case as well. I felt I'd been at this an awfully long time, and I'd seen the same issues repeat themselves, and really felt the futility of trying to change the world with a few words. But I was not as ready to leave as management was ready to change direction, as it were, and I hope to, to get back into the fray, in some capacity, join the all the minnows in the sea of bloggers.
The blogosphere.
Oh yeah. So I'll keep weighing in. I feel like really after covering Indiana politics all these years, I feel like a vegan who just escape the slaughterhouse, but I'll try to get my stomach back in shape to weigh in again.
It's interesting. On the day we're having this conversation and committing it to a computer, there's a really interesting war of words going on about the State Board of Education that's playing out in the pages of the Star, every day. And I want to go back to how you got lured into or lured yourself into journalism in the first place. You came of age in a generation that you write most eloquently about. And while, yes, generations are useful, sometimes those labels are more problem than help. But as a self-professed baby boomer, you came of age in a time when journalism seemed to be rising in efficacy. I'm thinking of the late 60s to mid 70s. Is there something about what was happening in newspapers in particular that caused you to say, I want to do this?
I think so. I think it was a more, I wouldn't say a more educated or intelligent era, but I think it was a more literate one. And people sat down with magazines and newspapers and read lengthy articles and knew the people, the relative handful of people compared to now, compared to the internet era, who were expressing opinions and writing, you know, the best feature stories and the best investigative stories. I wanted a piece of that, you know, from the time I was writing in a high school newspaper and seeing a byline and seeing, you know, classmates passing around. And I also very much wanted to be able to, you know, to vent my spleen, to broadcast my little opinions. And that took a while, of course. You have to kind of pay your dues to get that forum. But I really wanted to be the kind of writer that Hunter Thompson and Tom Wolfe and these other heroes of mine were, and to be able to, you know, do the so-called creative writing and the polemical writing.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you forged a career at both ends of that spectrum. I mean, I almost see it as a spectrum. Feature writing tends to be, not exclusively, but it tends to be apolitical. It tends to be neutral.
More descriptive.
Yeah.
And ideally less intrusive of your own personality.
Right.
You show your ability to actually get inside other people's heads. And,
right. You're an observer more than anything, and a describer.
Yeah. And the pride of that is to make it vivid and make it, you know, as Tom Wolfe always said, make the non-fictional read like a novel, and place the reader in that scene and in that time and place and in that character's head, if you can, and prove that, you know, through close observation and really strenuous reporting, you can bring it to life and make it seem like there's no intermediary. And then you move to the opinion stuff, and you want them to, to see you across the table from them.
So I assume there is a fairly graceful dance that happened behind the scenes in your newspaper life where you said, I want a voice, I want to express a particular not platform, but point of view, and your editors may have said, not yet, this isn't the right time, or maybe they came to you and said, hey, we need a so-called house liberal. How did that work?
I kind of slid into that in the first instance, because I had two stints of about a decade, or a little over a decade, where I was writing a column, and the first one was really conceived as a human interest feature type of format, like Tom Keating.
Mm-hmm.
There'd never be another Tom Keating, but they thought an additional person to Tom would be welcome because he was so popular.
Sure.
And I kind of moved from there, from you know, writing about interesting, unnoticed people in the community and oddities and just good stories into opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was tolerated, and I eventually moved away from that on my own. And when Andrea Neal took over the editorial page around the year 2000, she specifically wanted a house contrary opinion,
mm-hmm.
What she called the free marketplace of ideas, you know, and she She asked me to do that. The precedent for that went back quite a few years to Fremont Power with the Indianapolis News. And under the elder Gene Pulliam, who was an arch conservative, Fremont was way ahead of his time in liberal opinion, in support for the civil rights movement and attacks on anti-Semitism, things like that, which in the 50s and 60s were pretty bold. So I kind of saw myself taking up that mantle as another person I really admired.
And were you left alone? Did anybody, either direct editor or higher up, say, rein it in, buddy?
Until the last few years, I really was. I was, I think, considered their price of the First Amendment.
I hope that's on your resume.
But I think, you know, the management kept changing under new ownership, and the current management, the most recent bosses of mine, I think were just uncomfortable with the sharpness, I don't know what they consider, this incendiary nature of the column, and they wanted things calmed down, and they wanted more non-opinion, period. We couldn't really come to a meeting of minds on that. And it wasn't really political censorship so much as it was just a feeling on their part from a business point of view that, hard left opinion.
Wasn't selling papers.
Yeah, my rants, if you will, were turning people away. And I disagree with that. A lot of people agree with me, but I don't have any scientific polling to show them.
Sure. Some of the most interesting pieces over the years, and it was brought home to me reading them collected in this volume, are sadly obituaries. But
yes.
But they're often pieces that bring a political viewpoint plus the feature writing together, in the sense of choice of subject. Here is the story of the life of somebody you probably would never have heard about except for this piece that you've written. And a way to lift up some people that we should know.
That really struck me, the fact that, so many of these people didn't make it until they were gone.
Yeah.
In any kind of public tribute. The tribute becomes a eulogy.
Yeah.
And in several cases, I think they were such institutions, so well known to everybody, like Sid Marr, for example,
yeah,
who ran Atlas, such a maestro over those years. Everybody knew Sid, and I don't know, maybe a couple of times in his career, at most, somebody might have sat down and, actually written a feature or done a TV spot about him. But, the thing about institutions is, you walk past them so much, you're glad they're there. You don't really stop and examine them. And especially with people who are making history marginally or whatever, you wait till they've stopped making it and you write about them. And some of these who are in here, I had written about
when they were alive,
during their careers,
yeah. Yeah.
Here and there in my column, and it just seemed that the final piece was, an opportunity to be more poignant, and maybe to put them in context more, like Hyacinth Thrash, who was supposedly the only survivor Jonestown Massacre. She also represented, you know, the era of migration. She represented the power and the complexity of religion, American life, mm-hmm. and race, and her death. Reminded us how much of this young country's history can be wrapped up in a single life. And so, you know, one obit after another, yeah.
Sharon Gamble with journalist, essayist, fiction writer, poet, and student of human nature, Dan Carpenter. His new book collects some of his favorite Indianapolis Star columns. It's called Indiana Out Loud, Dan Carpenter on the Heartland Beat. And it's published by the Indiana Historical Society Press and available at many bookstores. And though he's retired from the Indianapolis Star, Dan is still writing. Look for his work on the IBJ's blog, IndianaForefront.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when we'll have our annual holiday show.
There'll be lots and lots of great holiday music from lots of local musicians.
And some other treats to stuff your stocking with.
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.